Welcome to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We'll talk to fellow entrepreneurs and share stories of success, failures, and epic failures in the quest to understand the business, art, and science of the indie revolution in the city of big shoulders.
Welcome to another episode of the Chicago Gamepreneur Show. I'm Kiwon Hong with my co-host Rob Locker.
Hello.
And we've got a very special guest on today's podcast. This is Rob Zubek.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Rob, I mean, you've got a long history, a lot of stuff you can talk about. Why don't you just catch us up on what you're doing now and then maybe delve into like how you ended up at your current place.
Sure. So right now I'm running a studio called SomaSim. We're basically building simulation games. That's what we're all about. We're a very small indie studio, two full-time people, several people doing part-time work, sort of trying to do this sort of bootstrap thing.
Right.
Running our own.
Rob and I are very familiar with that bootstrap concept.
Yeah. I mean, that's the so that will be interesting to talk about. Mm-hmm. But the way I got here is actually via a circuitous route that involved AAA games and social games and a PhD in AI. So it's it actually started at Northwestern.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing computer science first undergrad and graduate studies, and ended up getting more and more interested in games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the I ended up actually doing a PhD dissertation on AI for games. That was kind of cool. It was about conversational AI, so stuff you could use to build a conversational bot that you could talk with in natural language. So mm-hmm. that was pretty cool. What I actually wanted to do is go into the industry though.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up first going to EA. I started out on one of the Sims teams, since they had multiple teams. And
this is like a different time in the industry,
yeah,
right?
This would have been 2005.
Okay.
So everything was...
Before indies, before...
Absolutely, yes, mm. Yeah. There were people who were sort of thinking about this kind of stuff, Greg Kostikian sort of famously trying to push independent stuff, but there was very little of that. And, you know, this was the time when I arrived at EA, the thing we were working on was The Sims for next-gen consoles, which were then 360 and PS3, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and they weren't released yet. So that was a console generation ago. and so I was on that team sort of doing Sims prototyping. Then I got switched over to a Lord of the Rings franchise team. And that was sort of trying to do a Lord of the Rings game that was more like an open world RPG.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, it never shipped. So
happens. Yeah.
So after that, I actually quit EA and went to work at Three Rings, which was a tiny studio in San Francisco. Not that tiny, but their thing was casual MMOs. So there's a flagship game was called Puzzle Pirates. It was an MMO where you play as a pirate. You sort of go on sailing, exploring the high seas, and the way you do the combat mechanics is actually play Tetris or other puzzles simultaneously with other people on the ship. Very, very kind of cool stuff.
Yeah.
I did some game development for them. I did network infrastructure kind of stuff. Then I went to work at a small company called Zynga, which then grew to a large company. And there I worked on social games. So a game nobody's ever heard of, which was called Roller Coaster Kingdom, and then Cityville and Farmville 2.
Mm-hmm.
So that was fascinating to watch, because you know, those games blew up into these huge behemoths. And, it was kind of fascinating to watch, like what happens when you have 20 million people play your game every day. And then after all of that, I quit Zynga and decided to go into my own.
Mm-hmm.
In my own direction, pursuing sort of simulation, like more sort of hardcore kinds of games.
Okay.
Maybe not hardcore in the sense of shooters or something like that, but definitely.
But more niche games,
right? Yeah, not mass market, but stuff that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm. So the game that you, it's out now, right? Yeah. The one that you just did, 1849, right?
Correct, yes.
After, maybe you can give us the two-minute spiel on that.
Absolutely, yeah. So the name is basically based on the year when when gold was discovered in California.
The
49ers.
Okay.
Yeah. The idea is that you're a manager of a gold rush town. So you're it's a classic city builder in the very much in the vein of the classics like Caesar and Cleopatra, Zeus. Mm-hmm. These kind of mid-90s, early 2000s PC kind of town builders. The idea is you go to California during the gold rush and you actually build out entire towns, mining villages. You hire people. You build mines, you build stores, company stores for people to shop in. You have to make sure that they're happy, make sure that they're fed, make sure that they're working for you and all of that. And the workers are going to be very picky, so you have to balance, once balance your economy, two, balance your resource production. And a lot of the difficulty in the game comes from the fact that you have to basically manufacture everything yourself. You can buy some things, but you essentially have to build these giant production chains. And you have to manage logistics, so it's kind of a business simulation under the hood. but yeah, so that game shipped in May of last year, and we went out on PC, Mac, obviously, and tablets. So iOS and Android.
Very good.
Yeah.
So how's it been doing so far?
So far, so good. I mean, it's sort of. Niche game, so it's never going to blow up like any of the mobile titles, but it's doing fine, and it allowed us to get started working on the second game full time. So
right.
that's
well, when you have a small studio, right? You don't need it to be huge.
Yes,
you just need it to be successful enough.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, and that's kind of the way to drive this kind of a bootstrap business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so I'd love to hear more from it, but I'm going to throw a quick sidebar first, just because it's fun. Back when you were doing your dissertation in Northwestern, I was actually in one of your game design classes.
Right.
And one of the projects that we worked on was you built an object for The Sims.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to poke under the hood and you could make this object. And The Sims, like objects back then, had certain... So they would advertise certain properties, right? So you
Correct.
Would say it would advertise it, make you more social or something like that. And then... But in reality, it could do different things,
yeah.
right? It might make you more social, but it might also do other things. So the one that I made was a Sim keg. And the keg advertised that it would be fun, that make you social. When you use the keg, you get more fun and more social, but you also get like very tired. You would get like your bladder level would go like way up. So you have all these party drawers, Sims would be around the keg and never like want to pass out and want to pee all over himself. So it was a very fun object. I had a lot of fun with that. So.
Right. That was a fun class. That was Ken Forbes, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
It was Forbes' class.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. The programming model for the Sims was just very flexible.
Yeah, it was very interesting because everyone plays The Sims, right? But no one really kind of takes it apart and goes, like, how does each of these objects work? How do the interactions work?
Well, especially since EA didn't publish the language for everybody to use, we sort of got it as an educational institution, so we could do that. Yeah, but as a consumer, you never get the chance to poke under the hood in many of these games. Sometimes they release modding support or something, but most of the time you get the game, which is kind of sad because... Especially when you're dealing with simulations, you want to tinker with the rules.
Right,
you want to
get under
the
hood and see what's going on there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's something that a bunch of companies have done right since Steam Workshop started.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of kicked off with the Portal 2 level creator. Which was actually sort of advertised as an educational tool. A lot of teachers use it. To teach physics, even though it has wrong physics, because it has portals.
but you can experiment with
physics,
and that's what matters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then Rob's game basically is just making things under the hood and seeing how they react.
Yeah, I mean, there's a programming language built into the game, so, and the IDE for that language and the interpreter for that language. Are all built into the game, and I'm never going to do that again. It's way too hard.
But very interesting.
But speaking of programming, I noticed that you've kept up with a lot of AI stuff, and I mean, for obvious reasons, if you're doing simulation games, you're going to need, you know, the beings in this environment not to sort of walk into walls and do stupid things. But do you ever get tempted to come back to the conversational AI stuff?
I am. And it's kind of hard because the it's all about finding the right context for that. Because conversation, just regular language understanding is just too hard. We just give up on the dream. But understanding language in specific context actually can be pretty solvable. Like, especially if you set up the context such that the computer can ask for clarification, or it's okay for the computer not to understand some things. So actually part of the dissertation that I did was doing computational sort of tech for describing a narrow conversation model. So for example, you're in a store, right? You're walking up to a cashier asking for items. Like, there are only so many conversational moves you can make in that game, right? You can request stuff.
Those are frames, right, in the language of AI research.
Yeah. So there's only so many things you can do in the context, and what you did before kind of also constrains the next thing. So, like, you know, the cashier asks you for, you know, would you like a bag with your purchase or something? And, like, if you do a grunt or if you wave your head or whatever...
Or if you say plastic.
Yeah, that's going to be understood either as, like, yes or no. Like, they're going to converge your answer into one of those buckets. So part of my dissertation was basically building the tech that took players' inputs, which could be whatever, and tried to converge them into buckets based on what it thought the situation called for. So yeah, as you can tell, I'm kind of like, even thinking back to it, yeah, that was kind of cool stuff. I would definitely like to do more of that. At the same time, it's one, sort of requires finding a good context. Two, there's also other simulation stuff that I really want to do. So.
Yeah. Priorities.
Yeah, and always, like, the new stuff is always shiny and new and exciting. So it's
It's really one of the places I feel in gaming that we haven't explored enough, right? Mm-hmm. Because we explore a lot into... I mean, graphics has been where we've been pushing for, you know, 10, 15 years. And we just haven't done any
and
of this.
And combat AI is pretty advanced.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's getting very good. But yeah, like, conversation. It's still, you know, we're still doing the, you know, pick one out of four, right? Even Mass Effect, pick one out of four. We got nothing beyond that.
And
so
Jesse Schell, at the last, like, digital media and learning conference, said that all, like, games are really bad at above the neck actions. So, mm-hmm. like, you can walk around, you can jump, you can shoot, you can do anything that doesn't require you to have anything above the neck, but, like, in terms of, you know, facial expressions and conversation. And
part of it is also the controllers you get, right? Because if the only thing you have is the gamepad where you can move up, down, left, right, push a few buttons, having a conversation is going to be next to impossible. Like, you're forced to choosing from trees. With a keyboard and a mouse, that's okay. Now we can start, you know, maybe typing stuff in or selecting some things. But it's still hard because now if you give somebody a keyboard, they're going to try to trick the computer. They're going to mess with it. So right. If we found that some kind of a medium in between, but yeah, it's a huge problem.
Yes, absolutely. So how did you get into indie? Like, you did all this big stuff, and then you decided to go indie. Was there anything in particular? Was it just the market was kind of at the right place?
It was really wanting to sort of, one, make games that sort of I thought, you know, needed to be made, so games that maybe weren't so popular anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, the market has since, I think, shifted back towards simulation. But back when I started thinking about it, you know, it was a few years ago, there weren't so many simulation games. And also, we were looking at it from the perspective of there might be sort of an interest in the market in these kinds of more complex games on tablets.
Mm-hmm.
So we started explicitly with the intention of releasing a simulation game that is like, you know, PC simulation games, but also playable on tablets.
Mm-hmm.
So the design sort of took that into account, shorter sessions, but a campaign of sessions. So you build not just one town, but you build 20 different towns. And each town will take you maybe an hour or two. And there's, of course, a sandbox mode where you can just go wild.
Mm-hmm.
But in the directed mode, it's an hour or two, and that was sort of like that was our experiment to see, because we're expecting that there's a desire from players who grew up on PC games, who maybe didn't have the time to play PC games anymore, to like take their game on the train, take the game on the you know to dinner table or to TV with them, and just play it.
The idea of a short form simulation game is like totally untapped.
Yeah. So
well,
so
except for you.
And I would say a few games like FTL, for example, can be short form. Democracy 3 can be short form. That was basically one of the experiments we did with this to determine whether this mobile market is kind of interested in that. And that was an interesting experiment because the people who found the game were very positive about it, loved it. We got a lot of high
engagement, I'd imagine.
Yeah, a lot of good engagement and good star ratings from our players.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of nice comments. And it also helped that the game is not free to play. So people who did play it felt that it was a nice, refreshing change from free to play games.
That's true, because a lot of free-to-play kind of have like a simulation-like base, but you're always blocked, right?
Yes.
There's always things that block you. That gets frustrating. Yeah.
Yeah. So, So with free-to-play games, you will always have this sort of thing that forces you to either give up your time, which you don't want to do because you're having fun playing, or give up money. That was one of the also basic things that we didn't want to do. We didn't want to do free-to-play. Basically because we thought it compromises design choices.
Got sick of it at Zynga. You're like, enough energy meters.
Well, I mean, it works for the kinds of games that those were, right? I mean, Farmville, Cityville, they're very casual. They're very, like, pick it up for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, arrange your city, arrange your farm, and just let it go. It's very casual, very sort of low key kind of a thing, but what I wanted to do is a sort of high intensity, like, you know, sit up kind of a game where you're looking at an intensity and go, So from the experience at Zynga, I kind of knew what are the both the benefits and the drawbacks of the free-to-play model, what are the limitations, what are the kinds of design consequences that it's going to bring into your game. So you have to design your game such that people will go and feel paused, and then when they're being paused, they will decide whether to pay money to speed through it or not, and so on and so forth. And that's not how deep simulation games play, right?
Deep
simulation games really want to be these sort of complete experiences where the player gets completely into the made-up world. And everything is in there already. It's sort of like buying an entire box of Legos or box of toys, and you have the whole thing. You don't have to buy them one piece at a time.
Right, it's the Civilization One More Turn, right?
Yeah.
You want to get into that where you just keep going and going and going, and nothing blocks you, right? You just keep getting deeper and deeper into the simulation.
Yeah.
And then it's 15 years later, and your wife has left you.
You're living in a box with just your computer.
There was a cool image sort of making rounds on the internet a couple of days ago showing screenshots from Civilization 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 all in a row, sort of showing the progression. And it's just sort of like a huge nostalgia wave of like, I remember all of these. Oh crap, I've been playing Civilization for 15 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
We like to talk about like the business side of how games get made. So I'm interested in your production model. So you have two core members.
Mm-hmm.
And do you do outsource? We both do outsource a lot of our work, our sound, or that type of stuff. Do you outsource, or is it primarily you? And I'm assuming that you write code.
Yes.
Or,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It would be a terrible waste of talent if you
did. me on code and sort of like systems design. My partner Matt is on design and writing, sort of like level design, systems design, and so on. Then we work with, in both of the previous game and the current game, we've worked with two artists who are both part-time.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then for this upcoming game, we're actually working with a sound and
music.
Sound designer and a musician in order to get actual like, proper soundtrack and proper sound effects into it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exciting. For a previous game, we actually bought stock music essentially. And it was convenient, but one, you sort of end up with stock music, and two, YouTube actually gets super cranky about it.
Oh,
because it's managed by a big company and they will
do takedowns.
Absolutely, yeah. So so every time a YouTuber would play our game, they would get a takedown notice. Yeah, which we had no idea would happen, right, going into this. So it's a good lesson in, all right, so maybe this stock music is actually not as good of a deal as it appears.
Or you need to find the really obscure stuff.
Right.
That no one cares about magic.
I forgive me for not having done my homework and bought and played your game yet. But what are you charging for it? Like, what's your price point? And
We're charging $14.99 on PC and $4.99 on tablet.
Mm-hmm.
And that...
that's a high point for tablet, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Picking a price point that would be good for both platforms is just an impossible task.
Mm-hmm. I don't think people mind the difference.
Tablet people don't mind the difference.
Well, for sure. but like, you know, PC gamers are sort of understanding of the fact that...
Most of them, yeah. But most of them are very understanding of it, especially since on PC we sort of... we didn't initially have the sandbox on tablet because we had to do performance optimizations. So initially the PC version had the sandbox when the tablet didn't. And you know, so
and that justified
it was slightly different. So, but still, I mean, we got comments from a small minority. There was nevertheless vocal saying, "Hey, basically, why are you charging me $15 when the game is worth $5? Because they saw it on tablet for $5, and they therefore declared that it was worth $5."
Oh, and I think the thing is about price points is that you're always going to make some people upset, right?
Yeah.
Because even with the just PC releases, right? People want to price down for bundles, people want to price down for sales, and it always upsets part of your audience, but as part of your business, right, that is just a strategy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think part of it is just people who want to be in first are usually wanting to pay a little more, and then you just kind of get the tail, right? They want the tail, so.
Yeah, and the, we did comparisons beforehand. What do other people do? And yeah, I mean, $5 on tablets is quite high.
Yes.
Right? If you're Final Fantasy, you get to charge $7. You know, it's like that's not how the PC world works at all.
Yeah, it's the extra $5 for nostalgia, right?
Yeah. So that took a lot of sort of trying to figure out what's the best thing to do, and still, you know, no idea, like, is this the right strategy? Who knows? We compared a bunch of other people. So FTL, for example, did a very interesting thing. They released their PC version for $10.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I think, what was it, a year later, the tablet version also for $10. I have no idea how well it did, but that's a very kind of a interesting move because nobody else does it.
Right.
I'm really curious to find out
what
they
their numbers
did.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, mostly anybody who does PC and tablet or PC and mobile tends to do regular PC price and then a tuned down tablet price.
How was the development process? Did you start on PC and then move to tablet, or was it kind of you did both simultaneously? Or
our goal was to do simultaneous release.
Okay.
From very early on, we asked around, you know, whether it's better to do PC or mobile first. And we sort of settled on simultaneous release. I don't think we're going to do that next time, actually.
Okay.
But for that one, since we knew from the beginning we're going to do simultaneous, we were doing development, basically, development on PC and then check on tablet every time you change UI. Like, is this still working?
Mm-hmm.
Is this still reasonable? Then it kind of informed our UI aesthetic, too, because we were very sensitive to like small screen estate, real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we're only on tablets, we're not so flexible that we can fit on phones. But even on tablets, on small tablets, we still try to make it so that on small tablets we can read stuff.
Yeah.
So that was kind of interesting because I think because of that, the game does read a little bit mobile-like on PC, which was an interesting kind of feedback that we got after the fact that we just considered because we were making the game on the PC from the beginning, so of course it's a PC game. But there are little nuances of UX that that PC gamers are very accustomed to, and when they don't get them.
Buttons are small on PC.
Yes,
they're huge
exactly.
on tablets. They're 88 pixels at the minimum across.
Right. Yeah.
Well, rollover, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rollover is a big
yeah.
thing, especially for complex games.
Yes.
Right? You want a rollover, you want a text to pop up.
Yep.
Whereas in mobile, you need to click. So
yeah,
that's another. It's interesting. Like, from a design perspective, I like to start, if I'm going cross-platform, I prefer to start on mobile because you just have to simplify so much, right?
Yeah.
But in terms of developing on PC, just because it's faster, right? Your iterations are faster.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. Which side do you choose to come from on that?
So with the next game, we're actually doing PC first.
Okay.
And we're sort of going to expose a lot of the sort of really detailed simulation details in tiny little font, you know, with a mouse overs, we'll see. But sort of doing a lot of the breadth of details
mm-hmm.
of the whole thing, and then try to simplify it into something that's mobile friendly. Maybe additional sheets that come out that display the details or something. But yeah, also, I think in terms of building an audience, it's better to come up on PC first.
Okay.
One thing that was interesting was we got some players early on who assumed that because it was a cross-platform simultaneous release, that it was therefore a mobile port, and therefore not worth their attention.
Yeah. Weird.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, but that stigma does exist because Sid Meier's doing a game, Starships, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that you read is that, oh, it's going to be a cross-platform title. We're not sure if it has strategic depth. And that's funny because, you know, the platform shouldn't impede strategic depth, but there's this kind of heuristic that we say is like, oh, it's on tablet, it must be dumbed down, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's a mobile game, right?
Yeah.
It's like, mm-hmm. that says everything. So yeah, I mean, obviously you can
bigots.
Have complicated
platform bigots.
Yeah, and right. I mean, obviously you can have complicated games on tablets. They're more than powerful enough. But between the user interface and between the sort of the way the market has shaped itself, most of the tablet games are one way, most of the console games are another way, most of the PC games are another way, and people would perceive them differently. And that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. So how you didn't do any crowdfunding for your title, right?
No, we considered it. We almost did, actually. We almost did. We drew up a plan and everything, and then talked with our PR person who does press outreach for us, and she basically gave a very strong argument that press doesn't really consider Kickstarter as important as it used to anymore. And this would have been in, you know, late 2013, early 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And it has gotten even further down in that direction since then. So we basically replanned and decided to do an equivalent of early access. I think you could say it was early access on indiegamestep.com.
Okay.
Which is it's not Steam sized or anything, there's nothing is. But it's a indie-centered game site that has a very dedicated community. And that was very cool because we got a lot of feedback from the players. We sort of sold the early access version when it was, I think, 4 or 5 months before release. So the engine was there, all the logic was there, but the scenarios we were slowly building. We shipped a game that had all the gameplay, logic-wise and scenario-wise, but not much content, and we asked the community to help us figure out how to tune the content.
Okay.
And that actually worked really well. It was sort of like mini releases every 2 weeks with the new levels, and people will help us figure out like this works, this doesn't work. Yeah.
Anything
great
interesting
community.
Come out from the community that you wouldn't have thought of yourself?
Since we're mostly looking at particular levels, it was kind of feedback about levels.
Okay.
And about towns, because the game takes place in 20 real towns in California. So you get to rebuild Sacramento, San Francisco, Stockton, and other places. And you sort of follow the history of the Gold Rush, just things that we thought would be easy were too hard. Things that we thought would be hard were too easy. It's sort of standard. Like if you're staring at your own game for long enough, you lose track of how it actually looks to people.
Yeah. Well, difficulty becomes something because you've played the game 500 times, right?
Right.
So you have no idea how to gauge difficulty.
Right, and you just go click, click, click. I'm doing this.
This is so intuitive, right?
Especially if you're, you know, running tests for your code, then
yes.
You have to know, like, the shortest path to, you know, getting whatever action to happen.
Yes. Yeah. Another example would be the tutorial. So we start the game with a tutorial that takes you through everything. Just seeing what people did that we didn't consider, because when you put a player in front of a tutorial, they'll probably do a lot of unexpected stuff. You know, click on things that you didn't intend to click on, that kind of stuff. And you're like, oh, I should have thought of this.
Right. Whenever you make something idiot-proof, the universe brings along a new improved idiot, right?
Yeah, and you know, goodness knows, people are excited to play the game, so they ignore all the text. Like, nobody reads anything. So then you try to guide them gently, like, well, yeah, do this.
Are you looking to do the same type of early access for your next title?
Probably. That kind of engaging the community and having people play the game early worked well for us. So,
was there a different price point for the early access?
Yes. I'm trying to remember. I think it was $10. So it was a little cheaper. And I think we also did one sort of promotional sale. During early access to just to get even more players. So that was pretty interesting. I would like to do another early access.
Yeah, I think in terms of if you're working with a small studio and you can do releases frequently, I think it's a very good strategy to follow.
Yes.
Especially if you can charge for it.
Yes. And my only caveat would be to we would only do early access when we have a ship date in mind.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to get into the habit or into a pattern where
infinite beta.
Right. Early access sort of like feeds your development process. That's not right. You should be able to ship the game even if early access doesn't bring you a lot of revenues. Because it's you're using it to validate your game ideas, not to fund your continuing development.
Mm-hmm.
So where did the seed money come from?
Savings, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, it's completely bootstrapped.
Right on.
Yeah,
we're both in the same boat.
Right. Yeah. So you sort of give up the salary and work on this for full time and bet on the game that the game's gonna do well.
So why Chicago?
Couple of reasons. One is it's home.
You've had a couple of homes, it sounds
that's true.
Like.
Yeah, but I mean, Chicago's just an awesome city. Two, it's actually a really good city to bootstrap a business, especially compared to California. And three, like the
wait, before you go to three, why?
One, costs, right? The rent in San Francisco is right now $3,000 a month for a one bedroom. Yeah, when you're bootstrapping, Chicago costs go much further than that. And two, there's so many good universities, so many good people here who are interested in doing games, in doing creative work, in doing sort of computer stuff that's, you know, novel and kind of different from other things, who are interested in working on these things. Nice big pool of people who are talented and interested as I mentioned, universities that have people who get into programming, get into game design, graduate, and they sort of foster this community. And
are you getting paid by the tourism board?
I wish. and sort of after coming into Chicago, just looking at the indie scene and so on, it's just a very nicely tight-knit and sort of helpful scene, right? It's not, compared to California and Silicon Valley, where there are a lot of people who work in the game industry or used to work, or, you know, so they're sort of maybe doing their own indie thing, but there are so many of them that nobody knows anybody. And that's kind of, that's a very different feel. And also the, finally, the sort of the feel of the indie scene is more about building games and more about building interesting experiences, and maybe less about, exactly how am I going to do a startup, how am I going to do an exit, orienting your business around the exit and around the financial
MVP and MVPs don't exist for games.
It's right.
Well,
yes.
Well, your early access should be your MVP.
I guess that is kind of a case.
But it's not very
example.
Minimal, right?
No, that's the thing. It isn't very minimal. It's practically a
how long did it take you
point.
To get there from zero to
early
launching
access.
On early access?
So the game took us 13 months from zero to launch, and I think it would have been around 9 months from zero to early access.
Yeah. VCs don't want to wait that long.
Well, and also, I mean, to be perfectly honest, they're not going to get the kinds of returns that they're looking for from
right,
a project
like
true. This.
or most likely any game project,
yeah.
Which is why they've kind of abandoned the space, I think.
Yes.
Aside from sort of platform ideas occasionally get funded.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, there would things that have growth potential. Social games a few years ago, mobile games a few years ago, where you could really grow the player base, and then once you have a huge player base, then you can build a second game, or build a third game, and
less than yeah, it was
yeah.
more of a science than an art in some ways, because you could just like if I pay this much money, then I will get this much money plus.
Well, that's just like for VC, right? Because they have lots of money, so if they can turn that money into more money, then that makes sense for them.
Right.
Yeah. But it's interesting to talk about the lifestyle thing, because I mean, we're both working on our company as kind of something we want to do long term, and most of the people we've had on the show are people that whatever they're doing, they want to do it long term. This isn't like we want to do this and then kick it off
to
something else.
Down.
Like this
yeah.
is what you want to do for the rest of your life, ideally. So.
And you sort of find something that you really want to do, and you try to build a business around it, as opposed to trying to build a business first and then live your life later.
Well,
that,
I think
that
helps
work.
With the community fostering. Everyone knows that you're kind of in it for the long haul,
yeah.
So everyone tries to help everyone else out, because you know that you'll be around and you'll see everyone in the
yeah.
community. So.
They'll have a chance to get you back with another favor,
and so
rather
forth,
than
yeah.
like... Oh, I did a favor for this guy and then never saw him again.
Except on the TV. And
yeah.
Right, and with that also comes the idea that people are making games primarily as experiences, not maybe primarily. So, like, they're optimizing for quality of experience. They're not optimizing for revenue, necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And that changes their design hugely.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
So you're also teaching a class.
Yes. Yes, I am.
I'll hear more about it.
It's a it's called a game development studio.
Okay.
At the Electrical Engineering Computer Science Department at Northwestern. So it's sort of a studio class, trying to run it, I think sort of like art department studio classes. So people bring in their work to class and evaluate each other's work.
Okay.
So we started out doing some more sort of design theory kind of stuff, people learning Unity. That's a Unity-based class, and learning how to do sort of interact with a game engine, and also come up with the project ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Then they split into groups, and then two-thirds of the class is basically weekly iterations where they bring their games into the class, get feedback from other students, and also give feedback to their teammates. So they're both developing a game and learning how to do game development, and they're also learning how to maybe build out a critical vocabulary and critical skills in evaluating other games and giving feedback, because giving feedback is kind of an art too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that kind of art studio model.
Yeah. Well, it's also software development, right? Just making a program and making it work and having something to show. These are very difficult things that people often underestimate.
Yeah,
so,
especially since it has to be not just a program that does the right kind of functionality, but it's also an aesthetic experience.
Right.
So you have to take the user into account throughout the whole experience.
So how has it been so far? How's the feedback, the output been?
So far so good. I mean, we're only a month into the 3-month class, so we're just at the point where students have been building their stuff.
Are they in teams or?
Yes, they're in teams of 2 to 4 people.
Okay.
So it's like sort of good enough sizes where communication overhead doesn't become an issue.
Right.
But you can still get a lot done with more than just one person.
Uh-huh.
In terms of maybe majors coming out, are you attracting mostly engineering majors, or kind of more like a broader spectrum, getting some liberal arts or arts
any arts school?
Coming?
So the I think it's mostly electrical engineering, computer science majors.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I didn't expect was that the class was actually met with huge interest, so it filled up quickly.
Okay.
So if there were non-majors who were trying to get in and ended up on the wait list, they probably just didn't get in, which is unfortunate. I wish, I wish there were 5 of me.
Yeah, it's interesting because it does sound like a very design-centric.
Yes, absolutely.
It sounds like a humanities class, essentially, where you have to do some programming.
Yeah, and right, because... Right, and game development is such a weird discipline in that sense, because it does require a lot of hardcore engineering, and also requires a lot of design, and also requires sort of like understanding the user's, emotional experience of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It really pulls you in different directions.
Yeah. I was told that if you want to become a good game designer, you need to do 20 different things.
Yes.
You know, the best way to become a good game designer is just to experience different, go cook, go play a sport, do all that, and bring that all back to game design. It's not like you can just sit down and read a book on game design.
Right.
You have to bring in a lot of disparate
I think influences. A lot of, like, so that was sort of the wisdom about film directing, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then Quentin Tarantino arrived, who had done nothing but watch movies and direct movies. and I think people have now taken that too far in video games. Like, everyone wants to be the Quentin Tarantino of video games, which is why all the video games are about the same things.
A very narrow slice, right?
Yeah, but what we need is like Robert Altman of video games, or like Orson Welles of video games.
And goodness knows, definitely breadth is completely necessary, but you also need depth in your preferred area. Right?
Correct,
like,
yeah.
If your thing is platformers, if your thing is, MMOs or whatever, you really need to go deep and understand how the design process in that works too, but also bring in the breadth of other things so that you can take it in a different direction.
I think that's true of genre
mm-hmm.
games. But if you want to explore new territory in a genre, you definitely have to go deep because so much of it has already been plumbed before. But if you're making something totally new, like a Keita Takahashi game, like Katamari or whatever,
mm-hmm.
is just so weird and new that, what kind of research do you do for making that?
Yeah, there's a point where you have to say, I'm going to either ignore convention, or I'm just ignorant of it in the first place, so I can create something that no one else has thought of, right? Yeah. Because like when if you talk about like, oh, I'm going to build a shooter, there's rules for a shooter, right? But to get outside of that, like Portal, right? You have to say, okay, what's the first rule of shooters? The gun kills things. Well, I'm going to make a gun that doesn't kill things. What else can it do? So that's kind of throwing the convention out of the window.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It reminds me of a talk that Raph Koster did a while back about sort of like boosting your creativity and how you can take existing ideas and sort of by replacing assumptions, by questioning assumptions about, from genres, from styles, from mechanics, replacing them with other things, you end up in new directions. And that's absolutely very true. And if you're not well-read and sort of not just read, but well-experienced in the world, you won't know what to replace them with.
Yeah.
So that's... And also...
And you won't know if someone has already asked that question and answered it satisfactorily.
Right. Yes. And you need to be well played, as it were,
yes.
to know what else has been done. In my sort of personal perspective, looking at it from a simulation point of view, simulations are all about building systems that are abstracted models of real things. So you also need to look at the world and... try to understand as much as you can about everything as systems in order to simulate
how do
them.
Things interact.
Yeah.
Yeah. To get back to the class quick, I'm curious like what kind of games your students are interested in. Because I know when I started making games, right, there was a particular type of game I really wanted to make because that's what I grew up playing and that's what I wanted to create now. What are your students kind of interested in building?
So I think because it is a one-quarter class, and you know, basically they have 2 months to make the game. That kind of constrains
right.
how much they,
what
they can
build.
Do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
In a certain sense, it's too early to tell.
Okay,
it's
still
had,
kind
they're
of formulating
started.
Point.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've seen a spectrum of different genres and different kinds of things. Where they will end up, it's kind of interesting to see because their designs will change as they get feedback.
Mm-hmm. Are you going
to
have like a demo day at the end or
yes.
something? Can we come see the games that your
Absolutely.
Students have made?
Yes. Yeah, no, that'll be awesome. I haven't yet figured out when and where it's going to be, but it would be great to just, you know, get everybody set up in a conference room or something like that. Bring their games, have everybody do a pizza party kind of thing.
Sweet.
Yeah, that'll be fantastic.
Yeah,
cool.
Let us know.
Let's do it.
To dovetail in quick, Itty Bitty Bash.
Itty Bitty Bash, yes. I don't know if you... It's sold out.
Yes.
So sorry, listeners, if you don't have your tickets.
I got my ticket.
Yes.
So, yeah, this is a shameless plug, but we... You want to do the 22nd on it anyway? Just
sure.
It's really
yeah, I mean, it's an indie games party. We're showing... 8 games that you probably haven't played before or maybe can't even play except in that kind of setting, and it's going to be at the Bottom Lounge on February 25th, 7 p.m. to midnight, and I think it's $25 at the door, that's what I'm guessing. I don't have the website in front of me, but go to bitbashchicago.com.
So sold out, obviously successful.
Yes.
Are you planning doing more Itty Bitty Bashes between now and the big one, or is this kind of like
no,
the one
we probably
off-player?
Aren't going to this time, but maybe two in between the big Bit Bashes next year, and just keep adding more. We started a Google Doc of themes that has just been nothing but amazing ideas. I want to do all of them. So. The more Bit Bashes, the better.
Very cool. We are around 50 minutes, so why don't we go ahead and jump into our one reoccurring piece, the What Weir. And the What Weir is just, it can be a game, it can be a book, it can be a movie. It's just what we're doing for this
podcast.
We're
consuming.
What we're consuming, yeah. So you want to go ahead and get kicked off?
Sure. Let's pick on books because why not? I'm reading two at the time. One is William Gibson's latest book, *The Peripheral*,
okay.
which is kind of interesting. It's taking place in simultaneously. One thread of narration is taking place in a sort of a near dystopian future, and then a second thread is taking place in a much further, much weirder future, and they sort of intertwine in weird ways. And it's William Gibson, so it's got that sort of narration and vocabulary that just oozes with coolness, which is just fantastic. And then I'm also almost done with actually the War Games Handbook 3rd Edition, which
how's that been?
Fascinating. It's written by the guy who founded SRI, which
okay.
I think got acquired by Avalon Hill, something like that. And the book is actually fairly, it's a bit of a time capsule because it was written in the 80s, and the second and third edition were sort of small updates in the 90s and like the year 2000, I think, because it just barely mentions computer games. But it's been fascinating just reading about the guy's sort of mental model for how war games work,
mm-hmm.
and how people interact with war games. Two, his advice on designing them, sort of little eye-opening tidbits here and there, like.
Does this mean your next game is going to be a war simulation?
No.
Spoiler?
I'm actually not very good at war games. But it was fascinating to read that, for example, at the height of war game popularity, they tended to be individual scenarios. They tended to be sort of one-off battles or simulations. He likes to refer to them as conflict simulators. So he likes to think of them as actually setting up a conflict, setting up a scenario, and then you have to play through it and see how it develops with different people, with different kind of situations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about winning, but it's about figuring out what it was about that particular situation. But also, these were kind of one-off games with different rule sets and so on. And then Dungeons & Dragons came in later, and other kinds of systems. And those systems ended up with a unified rule set that you plugged scenarios in. And that was one of the reasons why they got very popular.
Mm.
So that was just one very interesting tidbit, thinking about computer games.
Yeah,
right? We do a lot of one-off games.
Right.
Yeah.
And we don't have a lot of standardized stuff that everyone uses.
Yeah, that they can plug their games into.
Yeah.
So it's just a fascinating fascinating book looking back.
Maybe Minecraft is that.
Could be.
Maybe it will be, yeah.
Because people do make different games that you play within Minecraft.
Yeah.
There's a League of Legends clone, essentially, within Minecraft.
It's amazing.
Well, not to mention that League of Legends is based off a Warcraft 3 mod, so at its root, it was a modification off an existing property.
Yeah.
So it is interesting.
Yeah, all the tower defense games, the entire genre.
Yeah.
Right. What have you been up to?
This is going to sound embarrassing, but I have been watching a lot of Friends, because it just came out on Netflix.
Yeah, the whole thing's on Netflix.
Yes. And it really is a window into what our lives were like in the 90s when this show was coming out. And you kind of see the genesis of a lot of popular culture in Friends. Like, people use expressions like BFF that probably most people hadn't heard before Phoebe says it in, episode... whatever it is. And now they're just like household words. Yeah, it's a fascinating show just because there's so many like permutations of the relationships between the characters.
It's a show about interpersonal relationships, really. That's
yeah.
what it boils down to.
And it's interesting when they choose to bring complications in from outside. And it seems like every episode is basically something happens to one or two of the characters from an outside source, and then the rest of the episode is them digesting that with the rest of the friends, and then they kind of spit something out again at the end of the episode, and that resolves the outside conflict. And sometimes there's internal conflict too, but it doesn't even matter. Like, it gets ignored, that Ross and Rachel are in very tense situations. This all sounds so stupid coming out of my mouth, but...
Well, I'm a huge fan of
you,
so...
It's... Yeah.
You could build a computational model.
I could blame my wife because she's the person who started binge watching Friends, but I had choices. I could have looked away.
I'm actually kind of wanting the Friends simulator now, where you have like the six characters and you plug in some external stimuli and it like goes and like bounces around and then spits something out.
Yeah.
Social pinball.
Yeah.
Yeah, social simulation is something that I'm really, really interested in and would love to talk to you about maybe some other time when we're nearly out of time.
And then this is actually, I took it off your Twitter, but I've been reading the Game Outcomes Project, which is very interesting.
Very cool stuff.
It's a survey they did over 300 some projects, and they wanted to test for, you know, a lot of different things, but it, you know, they find statistically significant correlations with things like crunch makes games bad. Like, across the board, there's no
imagine
situation.
That.
it's the thing, like, all developers know that crunch makes your product worse.
For the layman out there, what is crunch?
Crunch is broadly defined as excessive mandatory overtime, where you run into some scheduling issue or
and because these are computer jobs, they're not unionizable.
Right.
Which means that overtime doesn't mean overtime.
Right, these are just unpaid hours that your programmers, your QA guys, you have to sit there and you just try to put as much work in as possible over the short, or, you know, if you have 1 week, you try to cram, you know, 80 man hours into it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the kind of, if you're a developer, you know that your quality goes way down in crunch, right? That's always been kind of understood. But as a tool, all the studios seem to, you know, just keep it in the pocket and go, okay, we'll just crunch before E3 to get the demo out. And they kind of assume that crunch has to be a part of the culture, and now we're just showing that crunch is just bad. Mm-hmm. If you work 40 hours instead of crunching for 80, your product would actually be better, which is one of the really interesting things that came out of this. But, I mean, the whole project is interesting, a lot of interesting. Like, your methodology, if you use Waterfall, Agile, Scrum, doesn't matter. As long as you have a methodology, it doesn't matter
that
which
surprises
one you use.
Me.
Yeah. Which was shocking for me too, right? Because everyone has this assumption like, oh, if you go from Waterfall to Agile, you suddenly get these big... Nope. As long as your team is well-trained in whatever methodology you all choose, it works just as well.
Huh.
So I did post it up on my Twitter, and I'll repost it on the Facebook page. But if you work in software, not just games, you should go check it out. Read it. Very useful stuff.
Maybe we should take this time to give a shout out to our gracious sponsors.
Absolutely. Our first sponsor being InnoPrints. They do, if you need business cards, if you need posters, t-shirts, they do a great job. They're right here in Chicago, so you can pick up locally, and they're very helpful. Very nice guys. And if you go to their site, which is InnoPrints, InnoPrints.com, and use code CGS, you'll get 15% off your first order. And then our second sponsor,
nice.
Which is extremely relevant because taxes are coming
yes.
up in, what, two
I just was
months?
Emailing with Marty
mm-hmm.
this morning.
It is General Ledger, and Marty is your contact. And if you contact him and tell him that you heard about him on our show, you get a free half-hour consultation. And, you know, he'll answer all your tax questions. Saved my skin last year. It was a great help. And
yeah.
Listen, it's just, when you're running a small business, the last thing you want to deal with is wondering whether you did your taxes right or not. And then this is just, you go in, it's all taken care of. He signs off on it. So, you know, if the IRS comes after you, he gets in trouble too. So
he's incredibly competent. So.
Yes. And he has been
there's
doing this
no
for
danger
a long time.
Of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet.
And we have a new Twitter account that we just set up today. It's at CGSPod.
Very
so
nice. I did not know that.
Yes, we will run all our promos out of the @CGSPod Twitter account.
Great. Cool.
Right. So, yeah, I'm Q1 Hong, @Q1 Hong on Twitter.
I'm Rob Lockhart, @BobbyLocks.
And
I'm Rob Zubek, @RZUBEK.
And where can we buy
1849? Yes. Steam, probably Steam on PC is your best... most popular choice, Android, iPad, and
that's pretty much it.
All right, great. We'll post it up on the page too.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah,
thank you very much for having me.
That's been awesome.
Thanks everyone for listening again.
Thanks for tuning in the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you'll be back again to share more stories from Sweet Home Chicago.